early in the afternoon on January 15th, 1919, and the air hangs cold and chilly over Boston. A 10-year-old boy is picking up sticks and driftwood outside his house on Commercial Street. He's going to take the wood home to his parents so they can heat their house in the bitter winter. With his arms full, the boy bends down to pick up one last piece of wood. Suddenly, there's a thunderous rumble followed by a loud popping sound. The boy lifts his head and looks in the direction of the sound. A wall of brown, slow-moving liquid is racing toward him. The little boy starts running. But it's too late.
This is Mayday, a show about disasters and accidents. In this episode, we tell the story of the Boston molasses disaster, a story about 2.3 million gallons of molasses, corporate greed, and the devastating consequences that followed. The hosts of this episode are Luke Welland and me, Maya Nalani. Mayday is made by the podcast company Cast. In the North End residential area of Boston lies the Purity Distilling Company and its storage facilities. The company produces ethanol, an intoxicating agent found in alcoholic beverages such as whiskey and rum. But until recently, the ethanol that the company produced was used for something entirely different. Specifically, it was used to create explosives such as dynamite. To produce ethanol, the Purity Distilling Company uses a sweet-smelling substance called molasses. It's a dark brown, syrup-like liquid derived from sugarcane and sugar beets. During World War I, the demand for ethanol was very high, as it was used to create explosive materials for warfare. To store the increasing amounts of molasses that the distillery's ethanol production required, a new storage tank was built in 1915. The result is a 50-foot high and 90-foot wide blue cylindrical tank that can hold up to 2.3 million gallons. The molasses tank is placed near the North End's harbor and the railway running through the city. This location allows the company to receive large deliveries of molasses quickly and easily. After the end of World War I, Purity Distilling Company shifts production back to its previous mainstay, namely producing ethanol for alcoholic beverages instead of explosives. The molasses tank continues to be filled to the brim, and despite the looming onset of what will later be called the Prohibition, business is booming. During the Prohibition in the U.S., all production and consumption of alcohol is banned. The decision is announced on January 16th, 1919, but does not come into effect until a year later, in 1920. In January 1919, therefore, Purity Distilling Company is producing huge amounts of ethanol to meet the increased demand for rum and whiskey before the ban comes into effect. The company decides to paint the molasses tank dark brown instead of blue, symbolically to match the color of the molasses it contains. But one of the painters hired for the job suspects that the company has decided to repaint for a very different reason. In front of him, on the tank wall, he sees what look like small cracks. Maybe the new paint is there to hide them. The painter runs a finger over the rough blue metal and then dismisses his fleeting thought. If it had been anything dangerous, the company would have surely fixed it, he thinks. The painter dips his brush in the brown paint and sweeps across the wall with determined strokes.
Just a block away from the tank at 6 Copse Hill Terrace stands a 3-story residential building. The house is home to the Clowerty family, consisting of eldest brother Martin, his younger sister and brother, and their 65-year-old mother, Bridget Clowerty. Martin, the eldest of the siblings, owns a nearby pub called Pen and Pencil. Despite the job involving long and rowdy nights, Martin enjoys his work. The pub attracts many thirsty customers and business is going well. When he bought Pen and Pencil 3 years ago, Martin saw it as an opportunity to finally afford to move his family out of the 3-story house on the noisy main street. With the money he made at the pub, he could give his family a new, better life. Now, 3 years later, he has started looking at real estate listings. But Martin will never get the chance to bid on any of them. Martin's job at the bar means that he has to sleep during the day. Today, January 15th, 1919, he has worked a particularly long shift and is very tired. Martin therefore goes straight up to his bedroom on the 3rd floor. It's 5 in the morning. The rumbling sound of a train rushing over the tracks on the bridge streams in through the thin window pane. Martin fluffs his pillow and lies down in bed. He knows it's only a matter of minutes before the next train passes, and the rumbling sound once again floods into his bedroom. With a sigh, he pulls the blanket over himself.
Hey, it's Maya. I want to tell you about another podcast that I think you'll love. It's called Cautionary Tales. We're supposed to learn from our mistakes, but other people's errors can be instructive too. From efforts to control the weather that went disastrously awry, to the untimely death of the Segway boss, history is a treasure trove of mishaps and meltdowns that can teach us everything. Tim Harford of the Financial Times mines the greatest fiascos of the past for their most valuable lessons. Some stories will delight you, others may scare you, but they'll all make you wiser. Listen to Cautionary Tales wherever you get your podcasts.
It's just after noon on Wednesday, and the city is bustling. The horse carriage drivers are on their way to deliver their goods to various businesses in the city, and the clattering sound of horse hooves and wagon wheels echo in the streets. It's lunchtime, and people have taken to the streets in search of somewhere to satisfy their hunger. In the backdrop of the city, the brown, cylindrical molasses tank can be seen. None of the Bostonians know that something catastrophic is about to happen. But in half an hour, Boston will be forever changed. The mild winter weather feels inviting, and many city dwellers take the opportunity to slow down, enjoying the fresh air rather than hurrying across town. Suddenly, a rumbling sound followed by a loud bang echoes over the rooftops of Commercial Street. People look up towards the sound. They turn just in time to see the metal walls of the molasses tank giving way. The brown painted sheets of metal are torn loose and opened in all directions. For a moment, a 50-foot block of molasses remains where the tank once stood. Just a few seconds later, a shockwave sweeps over the city. People, animals, and vehicles are flung to the ground, and buildings collapse with tremendous force. The metal sheets from the tank and other materials picked up by the shockwave whistle through the air. They shatter everything in their path and block people's escape routes where they land. When the 2.3 million gallons of molasses that were housed in the now broken tank begin to move downward and outward, a vacuum is created where the tank once stood. Everything and everyone that had just been thrown over by the shockwave is now torn back by the vacuum, sucking in everything in its path. Right below the molasses tank, a 10-year-old boy is picking up firewood. He doesn't live far away and is soon going home to his father. The boy doesn't know that his father is looking out at him from the apartment window to check if he's safe. When the boy hears the rumble behind him, he starts to run, but his short legs do not carry him far or fast enough. He's knocked over by the shockwave and pulled back by the vacuum. As the molasses from the tank gushes out, the 10-year-old boy disappears in the dark wave, swallowed and lost. He is never seen alive again.
It's 12:30. Tavern owner Martin is sleeping deeply and peacefully in his bed on the third floor when the loud rumble wakes him. He opens his eyes and blinks to adjust to the light in the room. The rumble must have come from one of the many trains that pass by the house, he thinks. But something's different. Martin sits up on the edge of the bed and rubs his sleepy eyes. He's barely lowered his hands from his face when the house suddenly starts to shake violently and a terrifying creaking roars through the floors. The creaking comes from below, from the foundation of the house. Decorations tumble from their shelves. Kitchen supplies and dishes are smashed as they fly out of the cabinets. Several loud thuds can be heard from furniture being overturned, and the fragile walls of the house shake from the vibrations of the shockwave. The first shockwave is just the beginning of the disaster. Just a few seconds after the initial bang, the wall of molasses that people could see from the street started to move. The wave sinks from its original height of 50 feet to the height of 25 feet. Then it rushes forward. Despite molasses being a thick and generally viscous liquid, it gushes out at a speed of 35 miles per hour. The mild winter weather and the fact that the tank was filled with new, warmer molasses just a few days earlier have made the sticky fluid more fluid. The heavy brown liquid, therefore, moves as quickly as a car, a speed that can be lethal on the first collision. The 25-foot wave rolls forward, swallowing everything in its path. The residential area is flooded with a swift and sticky mass. It flows into all alleys and small streets, over squares and gardens, like a paintbrush, filling in all empty lines with color. People flee in panic, but are knocked over, drown, or suffocate in the wave. The molasses quickly clogs all airways, and for those who manage to get up again, it cannot be wiped away, even though the dying desperately claw at their faces to breathe. The house where the Clowerty family lives is sucked into the vacuum that was created when the tank walls exploded. The force of the vacuum is so strong that the house is pulled off its foundation and dragged across the street with the wave of molasses pouring into the area. Inside the house, family members are thrown around and tavern owner Martin, who just woke up in the bedroom on the third floor, loses consciousness. The family's neighbors can do nothing but watch in despair as the house disappears with the wave. The mad dash ends only when the family's house reaches the railway bridge and the fragile wooden house violently hits the steel beams that hold up the bridge. The house falls into pieces. All that remains of the Clowerty family's home is a pile of wooden debris.
The pieces of metal from the tank walls that weren't flung away by the shockwave are now floating at high speed along the river of molasses. A several-foot-long piece of metal from the tank strikes the support pillar of the railway bridge, bending the tall steel beams. The 24-million-pound wave of molasses surges over buildings with such force that they're completely flattened. When the molasses washes over the local fire station, it leaves nothing but thin shards in its wake. One moment, the building is standing proud. The next, it's gone, obliterated. One of the firefighters who had the misfortune of being in the building at the time of the disaster lost his life. The molasses continues to spread through the city blocks. The brown, sticky mass covers everything in its path and presses up against the houses. Where the force is strongest, the molasses pushes up to the window panes of houses. The delicate glass bends inward with a strained creaking, which turns into a piercing clatter as the cracks grow and eventually shatter. When the molasses flows in through broken windows, the inhabitants of the houses flee in panic. They run for the exits, but are met with the dreaded brown mass out in the staircases. The only way out is up. Several of them run up to the rooftops, hoping that they'll be safe. From the roofs, they can hear the hissing sound that the wave makes as it rushes through the city.
When tavern owner Martin regains consciousness, he feels his body soaked in something wet and cold. He tries to sit up to investigate, but something hard and heavy is on top of him. A pile of planks that have come loose from the house walls and roof are pressing him down onto the bed. Martin must exert considerable effort, but finally manages to tear them away. The ground beneath him is covered in molasses, several feet deep. Dazed and confused, Martin thinks he has fallen off a boat out at sea. Martin doesn't realize that he is still at home, in his own bedroom. A bedroom that no longer exists at 6 Copse Hill Terrace. Instead, it lies in ruins in the middle of Commercial Street, right under the railway bridge. As the wave moves further away from the molasses tank's location in the harbor, it loses its speed. But the wave slowing down does not mean the danger is over. Inside the ruins of the Clowerty family's house, and in the cavity that has formed under the debris, Martin wades through the thick, deep molasses, looking for his family members. But the steps become heavy, and he doesn't get far before he slips and falls. He lands head first, and the brown liquid finds its way into his nose and mouth. Before he can react, he swallowed several mouthfuls of the sweet molasses. It clogs his nostrils, and it becomes difficult to breathe. In a desperate attempt to get air, Martin grabs for something to support himself. His hand lands against the wide headboard, but it is no longer attached to the bed. Instead, it floats like a raft on the sea. Martin hauls himself onto the wooden headboard to take shelter from the sticky molasses. From his small makeshift raft, Martin makes another attempt to find his family. He shouts as loud as he can, but there's no response. But then he suddenly sees a hand sticking up out of the brown sea. He paddles forward as fast as he can and grabs the hand. Martin pulls the person onto his raft and begins to wipe the molasses off their face with his hands. In front of him, on the raft, is his sister. Together they manage to get out of the flattened three-story house onto the street outside. But their brother and mother, Bridget, are nowhere to be seen.
The wave's progress lasts only a few minutes, After 5 minutes, all the molasses has drained out of the tank and covered several blocks of Boston in sticky slush. Perhaps some believe that the worst is over. Despite it already being too late for many of those hit by the wave, people rush out onto the streets to help. Over 100 men from the Marine Corps are among the first to arrive on the main street, Commercial Street. A few minutes later, police, nurses, and even firefighters arrive, despite the fire station being one of the buildings destroyed by the wave. Together, they risk their lives to help those who are stuck in the molasses. The chill during the day has been unusually mild, but as the evening hours approach, the temperature drops rapidly. The increasingly cold January air settles over the molasses, which begins to harden. Suddenly, the viscous liquid feels like quicksand. Those who are stuck struggle to free themselves, but the more they struggle, the more embedded they become. The molasses hardens entirely, and it becomes impossible to move. Several people suffocate under the hardened mass. The molasses hardening also poses new problems for the rescue workers. Clearing away the debris that has landed on the injured is almost impossible. Wooden boxes, beer barrels, and torn planks crowd the area, along with the remains of cars, horse carriages, and metal plates from the molasses tank walls. The thick liquid holds the debris as well as the bodies in a vice-like grip, and as the mass hardens, it becomes increasingly difficult for the rescuers to see anything through it. With each passing minute, the molasses becomes darker and less transparent. People who need help get stuck deep under the now pitch-black surface. No one can see where they are.
At the same time, about 30 rescuers have gathered outside the debris that just a few minutes ago was the Clowerty family's house. Some of them help each other to lift rubble from the ruins. A young man has climbed up on top of the house to look for a way in. A little further away, a group of curious city dwellers have gathered to watch. Tavern owner Martin, who managed to get out of the house, runs up to the rescuers to ask if they've found his mother. But the men just look at him and shake their heads. In desperation, Martin calls out his mother's name, but he gets no response. Then he turns to the crowd and asks them to help look. After a while, Martin's mother, Bridget, is found inside the debris of the family's three-story house. For Martin, it feels like hours have passed, and he's completely exhausted. He breathes heavily when one of the rescuers turns to him and tells him that they have found his mother. But Bridget Clowerty is not found alive. Instead, she lies pinned under the collapsed roof. After the heartbreaking news, Martin and his sister are led away from the house ruin and the syrup-covered square. After a while, their little brother is also found. He's scared and traumatized, but he's alive. It is only when the wave has subsided and the syrup has hardened that the total devastation becomes clear. The light from the hazy winter sky is reflected in the reddish-brown syrup that has so violently torn the city to shreds. The square that just a few minutes ago was full of life stands quiet and empty. Cars, debris, and entire buildings have been swept away in the wave. And the local fire station has collapsed. In the dark, sticky mess on the ground lie hundreds of bodies, both people and animals. Where the syrup tank used to stand, now nothing can be seen but a pale gray sky. A total of 21 people die in the wake of the molasses wave, and another 150 are injured. The people in the city lose both relatives and homes. 11 months after the accident, Martin Clowerty's little brother dies in a mental hospital. Martin and his sister are convinced that his death is due to the trauma caused by the accident.
The Purity Distilling Company and their parent company, United States Industrial Alcohol, which owned the molasses tank, deny all responsibility for the collapse. Instead, they claim that they were attacked by anarchists who sabotaged the tank, causing the accident. It was revealed after the accident that the molasses tank was improperly built from the beginning. The metal used for the tank's walls was far too thin to hold the amount of molasses that the company had stored in it. The overloading of the metal resulted in several cracks and leaks. Instead of fixing the cracks, the company chose to paint over them with a dark brown color. Employees at the company also testify about how the tank groaned every time it was filled with a viscous liquid. The residents of the affected area do not believe the explanations, suing the companies for negligence. 3 years after the accident, the parent company, United States Industrial Alcohol, is found guilty and fined an amount that, adjusted to inflation, corresponds to around $11.3 million in damages. Of that sum, about $126,000 were paid out to each of the families who had lost loved ones. However, the real cost to repair the damage to the city was 11 times the compensation. The total bill amounted to $100 million.
It takes 6 months to clean up the devastation left behind by the molasses flood. With the help of sand and salt water, most of the molasses can be cleaned away. But replacing all the buildings, bridges, and telephone poles that have been torn down takes much longer. It soon turns out that the liquid has spread far beyond the area hit by the tidal wave. People who walked through the hardening molasses dragged the sticky mass wherever they went. Traces of the molasses flood could therefore be found in subway stations and bus seats all over Greater Boston, an area that spans over 14,000 square yards in three different states. And even today, more than 100 years after the accident, many Bostonians claim that during the hottest summer days, one can still smell the tickling, sweet scent of molasses.
This has been Mayday, about the Boston molasses disaster. The hosts of this episode were Luke Welland and me, Maya Nalani. The script was written by Joanna Lundblad and produced by Sebastian Manieri. Mayday is made by us at the podcast company Cast.